Hello, and welcome to Practical Significance, a podcast to inspire listeners with compelling stories from statistics and data science and to propel data-driven careers forward. Here are your hosts, the ASA's Associate Executive Director, Donna Lalonde, and Executive Director, Ron Wasserstein.
Welcome, everyone, to Practical Significance. Ron and I are really delighted to have Harry Stevens with us today. Harry is a journalist with the Washington Post and also an ASA award winner. So a twofer we have. So Harry, we'd love to get started by having you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your day job.
Well, thanks so much for having me. This is really great. My name's Harry Stevens. Like you said, I work at the Washington Post. I am the climate lab columnist. So I write a regular column about climate change and the environment or the natural world that analyzes data and presents it with cool graphics. For example, the story will be about how winter average temperature has changed in your town. And so it'll be an analysis of like high resolution gridded temperature data over time. And then it'll show like a cool map that where that's colored according to that change. But then I also like to include tools where you can put in your hometown and there'll be a database of like, you know, 50,000 towns and cities in the US and, you know, pretty much covers every place, tell you how your town has changed. And so it's a nice way to connect with the data. And so a lot of the stories are like that, really letting people personalize their understanding of the data. But then also various different stories about interesting trends in the climate or the natural world and trying to present it in a way that's accessible and hopefully cool looking too.
Well, it is definitely cool looking, but building on that, it really feels like data journalism has really taken off in the last few years. I wonder what drew you to data journalism and how have you seen the field evolve since you got started?
So I think my first real engagement with data-driven journalism was in the 2008 presidential election. Nate Silver launched his blog, 538. And this was before it had been acquired by the New York Times or launched its own website. And he was just doing it as it almost seemed like a hobby. It was very informal. It was just a really interesting way to look at the election, because there's so much punditry around presidential elections and people making sort of informal predictions and forecasts all the time without having any statistical or objective reason to believe what they're forecasting. And oftentimes people evaluate the likelihood that a forecast will come true based on like how confident the pundit, you know, asserts their position, and very rarely go back and check to see if they got it right later. And what I loved about 538 was that Nate Silver was trying to rigorously forecast the election in every state using polls, but he was also, and this continues to be true, he was also like a very shrewd critic of the media, sort of making some of the arguments that I just alluded to about the way that pundits, you know, make these forecasts without, you know, really doing much deep analysis or being held to account later. And that really appealed to me. And like at the same time, I was getting into like sabermetrics, because I was a big baseball fan, and the Moneyball had, I think, recently come out. And it was very exciting to me that there was this sort of new way of looking at these things that I cared about, where people were trying to rigorously question the assumptions that the experts held and trying to see if they were actually true. So that was just a really cool way of looking at the world to me. And at the same time, or shortly thereafter, the New York Times started doing graphics in JavaScript, which probably sounds kind of abstruse and weird to a lot of people if you're not kind of familiar with the web and how graphics are presented on the web. But for a long time, interactive graphics were done with Flash, which was a separate software. You needed to like install an applet into your browser, and kind of stopped working after Apple stopped supporting it. So I think 2010, 2011, the New York Times really started making these very cool interactive graphics that had things moving on the screen. I mean, they did this one thing about the budget where it was like a force-directed layout that was showing different budgetary categories as circles, and they were collision detection. So they were kind of bouncing around on the screen. And it turned out that all of this stuff I didn't know at the time was being created with this JavaScript library called D3JS, which was this creation of Mike Bostock, who's a software engineer, and he worked for the New York Times graphics department for a little while. But that JavaScript library, although I think fairly unknown outside of the world of graphics people, has totally revolutionized the way that visual information is presented on the web and made it possible for people to just make all kinds of very cool things. And so when I saw these graphics, you know, I didn't know how they were made or understand much about the code behind them, but I just thought that they looked really cool. And, it, you know, as somebody who, we got our first computer in my house when I was like 10. So I've been using the internet for a long time, and have seeing it be this, like this very creative, interactive interface was very exciting to me. And I didn't know how they were making those things, but I knew that I wanted to learn. Yeah, it's just a combination of the statistical analysis and then the presentation graphics really came together for me as like, a, wow, this is something that's really cool. And I want to be able to do it too.
That's great. Well, let's just keep going on these tools you're talking about. You mentioned JavaScript. Is that still your go-to? Are there other things that you can't live without?
Yeah, JavaScript's awesome, particularly for like if you're doing graphics on the web, because it just runs natively in web browsers. So you don't have to like compile any code or anything like that. It's not as good for data analysis. It's not bad. I mean, one thing, like it has some issues with like floating point numbers and stuff, which it doesn't really matter, it's sort of practical day-to-day use. But if I was like programming, a, I don't know, a rocket ship to re-enter the Earth's orbit, I might not want to use it. But the other thing is like a lot of times, you know, tools are useful based on the community around them. And there's just a much more like robust statistics community and data science community with Python and R. You know, I'm not writing a lot of libraries myself, so to depend on the stuff that already exists. So lately I've been doing a lot of math with gridded meteorological data, and there's like just not a lot of good JavaScript libraries for doing that, but like Python is, you know, has X-Array, and it's like really fast and pretty easy to use. So, you know, I do a lot of the data analysis with Python, but you know, I think my first love is really JavaScript. And, you know, the other thing is like, you know, sometimes I use Excel, like, you know, if I want to like a quick look at the data. So, you know, I don't really think there's like a perfect tool, but, you know, just nice to know how to use various different things. I don't even know what tool I'm using most of the time, you know, whatever thing that I turn to that seems to work quickly.
That's just great. And it's so fun to hear your enthusiasm for all the tools. So I'm going to go back to the award that you just won from the American Statistical Association. And the citation for the award says in part that Climate Lab stories that cover environmental change in clear, personalizable, transparent, and reproducible way. With so much data available these days, how do you get drawn to the stories that really matter?
It helps to start from like, what will the headline of this be? Because that helps you focus on topic or a story that's sort of narrow enough that you can describe it quickly, like describe it in a single headline. And also it makes you focus on what will be interesting to the average person. If you can you try to imagine yourself scrolling through your social media feed or looking at the homepage of a news website, more rarely these days, but some people still do it. And you see a headline, and is it something you want to click on? You know, is it something that intrigues you? And so I think about that a lot. So like, I'll give you an example. Just a story that I did recently was how mosquito season has changed where you live. So like, I thought that that would be interesting to people because everybody cares about mosquitoes, you know, they're annoying. And pretty much everyone has experience with mosquitoes. And, you know, if I saw like, you know, oh, how mosquito season has changed in my town, I'd probably want to click on it and learn about that. You know, that gives me like an opportunity to create some data visualization, you know, showing how mosquito season has changed across the country, but also to like explore issues related to how it's like certain climatic conditions are more suitable for mosquitoes than others, and how those climatic conditions have changed over the, you know, sort of observational record. And then I had done a story earlier this year about bird data and how bird populations are changing, you know, across the country. And with that one, you can use direct observations of birds because there's just a lot of birders. Like human beings, for whatever reason, are drawn to birds. And probably people have been birders for as long as there have been people, really, you know, and at least in some informal sense. I'm not a birder, so I didn't know about this, but there's just a huge community of passionate birders. So there's this website called eBird, which has leveraged this very common hobby for scientific purposes. People upload their observations into eBird, and then they can do all kinds of analysis on these observations to track trends over time. And all of that is to say that no analogous community exists for mosquitoes. There's no mosquitoers as far as I know, or if there are, they're just not that many of them. Maybe there's some like entomologists out there that go and track their backyard mosquitoes, but it's not that common. There are some databases of mosquitoes, sort of local, even at the state level, mosquito observations that experts are making, but it's not nearly as robust as birding community. And there's not a huge community of people like citizen scientists uploading mosquito observations to a database. And so as a result, like people who want to study trends in mosquito abundance are left often using like meteorological data as a, and so, you know, that was something that the article explored a little bit as well, is like, you know, how do you even begin to guess what the trend in mosquito abundance might be, which I, you know, thought was pretty interesting. And, you know, it's also an opportunity to explore stuff with mosquito-borne diseases. And, you know, I talked to a woman who had West Nile virus, and it sounds pretty terrible. Made me look at mosquitoes in an even less favorable light. So yeah, you know, usually it's just like a kernel of an idea that can be represented as a headline, and then that gives you an opportunity to explore some topic that hopefully will be interesting to people.
That's great. And it's easy to see why people would be drawn to stories like you're just talking about. Underneath these things, oftentimes the data is quite complex and you have to figure out how to manage that. So what's the secret to the art of balancing how much detail you have with readability? How much geek like me is going to want to see in the story versus what will make normal people flee from the story once you start getting into those kind of details?
Yeah, I think that there's really no way to completely satisfy everybody. And with journalism, like necessarily, you're going to have to not include every detail. Like I always try to put caveats in, but like inevitably, you have to get rid of some of like the, you know, everything that you did with the data manipulation and, you know, why I chose to use to show an anomaly rather than the slope of a linear regression. Like I'm not really going to get into that in the body of the story. I do have a section at the bottom of every story now called Check My Work, where I sort of explain the methodology and then I link to some computational notebooks so that people can, not all of my code always, but try to put as much as I can just into these computational notebooks so people who are curious can actually go in, and sometimes people actually do, which is pretty cool. So that's one way to do the balance. And yeah, I mean, I think that regular readers are pretty smart. So, you know, they're comfortable with caveats and, you know, you just explain sort of the shortcomings of the data and, you know, just try not to linger on it too much and get into the meat of what's interesting more.
So Harry, lately Ron and I have been talking with our guests about AI technologies and the impact of AI technology. So I have to ask you, how do you see AI impacting data journalism, and is it going to transform the stories that are told?
Yeah, I think it has to. I mean, it's hard to project far out into the future, but like, you know, there is a possible future where like, I don't even have a job, right? Because you could just have a large language model or something like that just do everything that I do. But I don't think that's in the immediate future, so I should be okay for a little while. And more presently, like I'm already using ChatGPT for coding, for like help with my coding. Like back when I was learning JavaScript, you know, that was over 10 years ago now, like I had to learn it from just reading tutorials on the internet and Stack Overflow, which, you know, I'm not complaining. Like that's actually very fortunate, right? Like if you were learning how to code in the 70s, you'd have to learn from like textbooks and professors. And it was probably much more difficult, right? You couldn't just Google, like, I'm getting this error. So by the time that I was learning JavaScript, like, you know, already learning how to code was a lot easier. And now it's just crazy how much easier it is. So I've been doing a lot of Python in the last couple of years for reasons that I mentioned, like, because with meteorological data sets, it's useful to use Python. There's a big community around it. And like, I'm not using Stack Overflow anymore. Stack Overflow is, you know, for those who don't know, it's just a website where people ask questions if they're having coding problems usually, and somebody hopefully answers them. It's like a forum. You know, ChatGPT has basically ingested all of the knowledge that's present on Stack Overflow. And so if I'm struggling with a error in Python. Like I don't Google it so much anymore or go to Stack Overflow. Like I just ask ChatGPT and it is very, very good at diagnosing errors in code. It's really well tailored for that. It's like understanding structure. It's just very, very good at it. If it gets something wrong, you just run the code and it tells you, and you know, you got your error and then you go back to ChatGPT and tell it what the error is. And it's this iterative process. It's like you have this expert programmer that's just sitting with you and helping you write the code. For somebody who codes, it's like a really transformative technology. You know, I imagine that that's only going to continue to improve. It's really exciting, right? Because like a big barrier to entry for doing statistical analysis or like making interactive graphics is like the sort of this onerous process of learning how to code and takes a while. And so anything that will make that easier and faster so that people can spend less time like remembering the syntax of a programming language and more time, you know, thinking deeply about like the structure of the actual problem they're trying to solve. That's just better for everybody.
So a couple of the reasons that you will have a job indefinitely, in my view anyway, is that the sort of thing that ChatGPT is not good at and may not be for a while is recognizing where there are biases and certainly in recognizing where there are ethical issues involved. And so as a journalist, all these are pre-AI problems, right? You still had to deal with bias and you have to think about ethics. And so what do you do to ensure that your work is unbiased, recognizes the biases anyway, recognizes ethics, especially when reporting on complex issues? It's really cool to know what's going on with climate and mosquitoes and so on. But a lot of the other things you deal with, people are going to make decisions based on and adjust their thinking based on. And so how do you deal with those kind of things?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty tricky, like, because journalists aren't experts. I mean, when you cover scientific issues, like you're wading into some field that you're not an expert in. So obviously there's a huge possibility of messing up. For example, like even like during the pandemic, there were statisticians who were getting criticized for doing epidemiology, right? But certainly like a statistician has probably more subject matter expertise that would prepare them to do epidemiology than a journalist, right? But journalists, for some reason, like didn't get that same criticism of being sort of like epistemic imposters or something. But like we should be, I think, not necessarily criticized, but we should be held to a standard where, you know, we try or accurately represent the best available knowledge of the field that we're trying to cover. And in order to do that, like, I mean, I think you have to like read scientific papers and you have to try to talk to people who disagree with each other, because there are always like really smart people who nevertheless disagree. And that's true, I think, in any scientific field, including climate science, right? Like people always like to talk about scientific consensus in climate science because that's like a sort of a useful talking point. About a lot of things, there is scientific consensus. I mean, I think there's a lot of scientific consensus that like, you know, humans are adding carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases like methane to the atmosphere, and the change in atmospheric composition is, you know, must increase the mean temperature of the planet, and that, you know, increasing the mean temperature of the planet will have certain other effects. But there's a lot of scientific disagreement about, you know, things beyond that. You know, like what will the specific effect be on hurricane activity, you know, in terms of intensity and number? You know, there's scientific disagreement about that. Or, you know, what will the effect of reducing the sulfate content over the oceans as a result of a ban on SO2 in shipping fuel, like how will that affect warming? And, you know, people disagree about that. And I think that if you're being a good journalist and covering science, like you have to talk to all the smartest people who are disagreeing with each other and try to understand why they're disagreeing with each other, because that helps you sort of, you know, triangulate, like these are the smartest people and this is what they think. And as a result, like you're necessarily going to represent one of the positions that turns out to be wrong, right? Because like if smart people are disagreeing with each other, like one of them's right and one of them's wrong, or one of them's closer to being right than the other one. But as a journalist, like you don't know which one's right. And so like the best thing you can do is to just in good faith try to represent all of the perspectives as accurately as possible. And then hopefully the reader will be enlightened and educated by reading about that. At least that's what I think.
That's really interesting. And to follow up on that, I think maybe before we started recording, you said something about it's fun to interrogate the data, which I love that phrase, actually. But I'm curious, has there been a time when that interrogation has told a story you didn't expect?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of cases of it. The first column I wrote for Climate Lab was about human mortality from temperature. And, you know, it just turns out that cold is linked with far more human deaths than heat is. And that's a fairly robust finding. Like dozens of peer-reviewed papers have found that there's some positive ratio of cold to heat deaths among human beings. And so as a result, like there was one paper that was published recently that showed that at least over the last 19 years, as the average temperature of the planet has increased, you know, the number of deaths associated with heat has increased, but the number of deaths associated with cold has decreased by a larger amount, right? And so the increase in temperature may have resulted in less human mortality, specifically from temperature. I'm not saying from any other things related to climate change, which is like an interesting and sort of counterintuitive finding because, you know, most of what you hear about climate change, and I think rightfully so, are the negative effects from it. And I say rightfully so because I think people, you know, want to know or be prepared for bad changes that are likely to come, right? Like good changes you can handle in stride, bad changes you need to adapt for. So anyway, that was an interesting finding. And it also it's like, as a result of this empirical finding that temperature-linked mortality is likely to have decreased over the last like 19 years, you know, that's turned into fodder for people online saying like, well, look, global warming is good because deaths from temperature are going down. But then, you know, it turns out that the actual story is much more complicated than that because, you know, the planet doesn't just have one temperature, right? So like average temperature may have increased across the whole planet, but the changes are different, you know, depending on where you are. And so it just turns out, at least according to the sort of best available projections, that in the sort of wealthier world where temperatures happen to tend to be lower, tend to be colder parts of the world, you know, mortality from temperature is in fact expected to decline. But in the poorer parts of the world where temperatures tend to be hotter, those are the places that are likely to get hit hardest and where mortality from temperature is expected to increase. And that might be the whole crux of the climate problem is that like a lot of the people in the poorer parts of the world might have to face the negative impact more than the people in the wealthy part of the world. And I think there's an inherent unfairness in that bothers a lot of people. So, you know, I thought that was just it was an interesting story. You know, it starts from, that's interesting, and an opportunity to explore the nuance of something without necessarily saying like, oh, it's a catastrophe, we're all going to die, but also not leaning into the idea that, hey, you know, everything's fine.
Well, that's a really good example. And going back to something that you said earlier about how you were inspired to go into the kind of work that you do, there's no doubt that you and other people who are doing the work that you're doing are inspiring others. So for that person out there who's thinking about, hey, see these cool graphics? This would be a pretty cool thing to do. Or see this interesting story? I never would have thought of it that way. Somebody wants to be a data journalist now that you've worn that mantle for a bit. What's your advice? What sort of skills should they add to their basic journalism training? And what do you want to give somebody to give them a leg up as they're starting out in a career like this?
I mean, there's some stuff that I guess it's maybe kind of obvious, like good journalists tend to be curious. I don't think that you'd want to do the job unless you're curious, but you know, be willing to be wrong. Or when you go into a story, you know, don't think you know what's going on before you start reporting. Don't start from a conclusion, right? Which I think is also good science too. It's like, you know, you go into the lab genuinely curious, like about what you might find out. You don't know the answer before you start investigating. I think that's a good trait for a journalist to have too, because then, you know, you learn something new and you also get to bring your reader along with you on the process of discovery, which is a fun experience for a reader. And as far as the technical stuff goes, like if you want to make cool graphics now, like it's good to learn JavaScript, in my opinion, and just because the web is still like the main platform for doing that. But the thing is, like, it's so hard to anticipate how things are going to change. And like, there are people who are doing really cool graphics in like video format, you know, making like videos that they put up on YouTube, and they're not using JavaScript for that. So it's really hard to say like what specific tool you should learn. But I think, you know, you should go towards the medium that you personally like. You know, you should try to make stuff that you personally would want to see, because it's easier to get good at something if it's fun for you. You're just much more likely to progress quickly if you're having a good time.
I love the advice of just be curious, Harry. That's great. I think that's great advice. No matter where you are in your educational trajectory, right? So I'm going to shift gears as we come to the end, because we have a tradition of asking our guests about what they're reading, listening to, watching, playing on video games. All of the above is fair game. So what can you share with us?
So I have like various books that are like in my top all-time favorite books. I mean, right now, the book that I'm reading like at home is I'm doing the Neapolitan series, my brilliant friend and all those books. You know, I saw that they were highly regarded, and I like reading, you know, good fiction because it's fun, but also because when you read a good writer, then maybe it's, you know, some of it will rub off on you and you become a better writer too. As far as like books that have been like, whoa, like kind of changed the way I look at the world, one that I'd really recommend is Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, just about cognitive biases. He's sort of one of the founders of behavioral economics, even though he's a psychologist and not an economist. But just him and his partner, Amos Tversky, were very good at revealing the ways that humans systematically make mistakes in our thinking, you know, predictably make mistakes in our thinking. And I think it's very good to be aware of the way that your mind can fool you. And that's not like it's not a cure for your mind fooling you. I mean, Kahneman himself, I'm gonna paraphrase him, but basically, like, I've been studying the ways that people make mistakes in their thinking my whole life, and I'm still no better off. You know, I still make mistakes in my thinking all the time. So it's not a cure, but I still think it's just a useful way to be able to look at how you're thinking, you know, and how you might be making mistakes in your thinking, and then how other people are making mistakes in the way that they think. And I just think it's a useful tool set to have when you go around in the world.
That's great. Well, I will give a shout out to the book critics of the Washington Post, because I really appreciate their recommendations. So your colleagues at the Post are doing me good.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, they're the best.
They are. Well, thanks very much, Harry. This has just been fantastic. And we've really enjoyed talking with you. And now the other tradition of practical significance is for me to turn it over to my co-host, Ron, for Ron's top 10.
Thank you, Donna. I was at an international conference recently when someone mistakenly thought that I was the Wasserstein of Wasserstein distance fame. I could only say, I wish. That guy is somewhat older than me and way smarter, and his last name is Russian and spelled differently. But it got me to thinking that there really should be some statistical or other concepts named after me to get that process started, and no doubt to bring out a bunch of jokes at my expense. Here is the top 10 concepts that should be named after me, Ron Wasserstein. Number 10, the Wasserstein Prior. Like me, it's non-informative and also unhelpful. Number 9, the Wasserstein Fudge Factor. To use it, multiply my answer by the right answer divided by my answer, unless my answer is 0, in which case just use the right answer. Number 8, the Wasserstein Deductive Method. The most widely used of my eponymous methods, this clever strategy deduces that anything repeated often enough must be true. Number 7, the real Wasserstein distance. This metric indicates how far people prefer to stay away from yours truly and is expressed in astronomical units. Number 6, Wasserstein's last theorem. In the margins on an early page in Stephen King's The Shining, I wrote, I have a proof that if Jack Torrance had been a Bayesian, he would have immediately quit this job. Number 5, Wasserstein's corollary to Murphy's Law. Anything that can go wrong will go wrong, and you will be blamed for it. Number 4, Wasserstein equation. This is too complex to explain here, but the Wasserstein equation essentially shows that any two things already proven to be equal are in fact equal. Number 3, Wasserstein's law of large numbers. It turns out that the number of times you can unsuccessfully explain to people that they aren't going to win the Powerball jackpot is countably infinite. Number 2, the Wasserstein number. A synonym for infinity, the Wasserstein number is my Erdős number. And the number 1 concept that should be named after me, the Wasserstein dilemma. pie or a cake? Well, that's it for this episode of Practical Significance. Thank you for joining us. We look forward to continuing the conversation next month.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Practical Significance, the podcast of the American Statistical Association. A new episode will be coming your way next month from AmStat News, the ASA's monthly membership magazine.